listening to CPR, communitypublicradio.org. And this is Weekday World. I'm your host, Don DeBar. With a report of some of the news and events of the past 24 hours from the CPR newsroom. From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar.
This is something that's very special for our manufacturers and for our farmers from both countries, for all of the people that work for jobs.
That was President Donald Trump on Monday announcing that a new deal had been forged between the U.S. and Mexico inside the parameters of NAFTA.
It's also great trade, and it makes it a much more fair bill.
After the announcement, Richard Trumka, the president of the AFL-CIO, was asked by an NPR reporter if he thought that the revisions that had been obtained by the Trump administration were going to help his membership.
From what we've heard, I do. The current version of NAFTA has harmed small farmers, ranchers, businesses, and working people all across North America. And the only clear winners so far have been global corporations. This is trying to reverse that in many areas. Look, if we give Mexican workers higher wages, they're going to be able to buy more products. If they can buy more products, that increases demand for not only Mexican-made products, but U.S. and Canadian-made products. When their wages rise, all of us begin to win.
For more on that, we spoke with Professor Tony Montero from Philadelphia via Skype on Thursday. Well, you heard it. What do you think?
Yes, and it's very important what Trumka said, because what he's saying is that the only way to get beyond the economic recession of 2008-2009, which is still with us if you're a worker or if you're a poor person, and certainly if you're a black or woman or Mexican or Puerto Rican worker, you're still living the Great Recession. And what Trumka is saying is two things. One, that the only way to finally get beyond that is to put more money in the pockets of workers in the United States, in Mexico, and in Canada. And he was addressing that provision, and we don't know the whole deal with Mexico. We only know its basic architecture. But this idea that any worker in an auto plant owned by the United States must be paid at least $16 an hour, and that includes Mexican workers. So this idea that Mexican workers will be paid $5 or $10 an hour and American workers close to $30 an hour, which then makes it profitable for auto corporations to go to Mexico rather than to stay in Michigan or Wisconsin or anywhere else. So that's important. The other thing that I think Trumka is saying is that these multilateral trade deals like NAFTA, like the Trans-Pacific Partnership, have impoverished workers in the United States and throughout the world. And he agrees that in terms of trade agreements, we must go from the multilateral, these supranational agreements, to bilateral trade agreements where the interest of each nation, and from the standpoint of Trumka, the working people of each nation must be considered in any negotiations. So he's supporting this kind of bilateral trade agreement. And he's also saying implicit in that is the move back from this neoliberal globalization. Now, of course, finally, Trumka is taking a big risk because by the labor movement, which, by the way, most of the big industrial unions, including the Teamsters and the UAW and United Steelworkers and the International Association of Machinists and the AFL-CIO, met two Mondays ago at the White House with Trump concerning the NAFTA agreement.
Right.
But what Trumka knows he is doing is that this could be the nail in the coffin of the attempt of the Democrats to take the House of Representatives back. Certainly, the labor movement will not be out there stumping for Democrats who oppose this new tweaking or revising of NAFTA. They're not going to do that. They will support Democrats or Republicans who support the labor movement's position on trade. So what Trumka said and what Trump did in this renegotiation will have large impact politically on the midterm elections.
Yeah, for sure. It was remarkable to me just to hear the head of the AFL-CIO.
Oh, yeah.
And particularly, I mean, Trumka actually is, you know, out of the group of people that have come to the leadership of American labor unions over the last decades, he's about as left as they've come.
Yeah.
And for him to be looking at this in those terms, in other words, outside the parameters of what would be the best thing for me to say to get Democrats elected and rather say what's going to be the best thing for the members of my union.
Absolutely.
That's kind of remarkable. And the backdrop, it's interesting because that was that conversation took place on Wednesday. And on Tuesday or Monday, I forget which, the Urban Institute released a study. It was published on the 28th by them, I think. And it showed, in terms of the landscape, I mean, you talk about coming back from 2008, you know, the conditions that people are living through, that not everybody has recovered. As a matter of fact, some 40% of households mm-hmm. have some experience with one or another necessity of life having to be skipped over in the past year. For
right.
example,
absolutely.
40% had to skip a meal. You know, on a regular basis. 10% skipped a mortgage payment or rent. And in between, 24% had hardships with medical care where they didn't take, 18% of respondents didn't pay medical bills because they didn't have money. 17.8% didn't get medical care they needed because they didn't have money. 13% missed utility bill payments. In other words, a sizable part are having trouble just, you know, coping with day-to-day life.
Yeah, and see, here is where Donald Trump's political rhetoric and political strategy goes up against the real life realities of people that voted for him. You see, he's touting that the economy is growing and the stock market is breaking records and so on, but 40% of the U.S. population, which we're talking about, the majority of working people in this country are still in a deep economic crisis where they're not eating, where they're not paying their mortgage, where they're not paying their insurance, where their car note is not being paid, and so on. So he is not addressing the fundamental life conditions of the people that voted for him as an insurgency, as a statement to the economic and political elites. So on the one side, the NAFTA agreement is very good for a part of the working class, but it will take years, even with that agreement, for people in the auto and steel industries to recover. And that does not even speak to the larger number of workers who are in service, in hotel, in government jobs, not to mention adjunct and non-tenured professors at big universities who often are homeless and living in their cars and are not eating. And so I say all of that to say that the crisis that made Trump the president, the political and economic crisis, continues.
That's right.
And I think that he has done very little to speak in substantive terms to the crisis of everyday living of the vast majority of working people.
Well, again, the same study, for example, is provides a roadmap to the solution to that problem if he's interested.
Right.
Because it says here, for example, adults under the age of 35 were 8.6% more likely to report financial hardship. Mm-hmm. Women, black folks, Hispanic folks, single adults more likely to struggle to make ends meet. So if you're going to try to, you know, produce some material benefits to people of your administration that in turn will have, you know, translate into political support, it seems that that would be a good way to target it. Would be
who's
feeling it worse,
you
right?
See, yeah. He just can't keep saying black and Latino unemployment are at historic lows.
Right.
That might be true. But the big question is labor force participation.
Right. As well.
And the next question is this flatlining of wages over the last 30 years.
Right.
And you know, in other words, I say that to say that the political crisis of 2016 that produced these insurgency movements in both parties, Bernie Sanders and Trump, that crisis continues and has perhaps deepened. And I think in a real sense, the political environment is more uncertain today than it was in 2016. And for example, if you take the Democratic primary in Florida, where Andrew Gillum, this black mayor of Tallahassee, wins over a establishment Democrat who was supposed to win.
Right.
And that only happens because the party is in a state of crisis, of really breakup, of division. And I think that is the case with the Republican Party.
Yep.
Although, and I would not, and I caution against making the mistake of saying what what the elected officials in the House and the Senate say, what those Republicans say, they're with Trump on X, Y, and Z, I would not take that as an indicator of what's really going on in the base. I would not even take the polling data that 40% or 89% of the Republicans are still with him. I wouldn't take that as an indication of the unstableness within the Republican Party, especially at its base.
Yeah, I mean, I think you can't assume stability regardless of... First of all, yes, you can't rely on polls for very much, at least... Yes. Unless you're going to dig deep into them and look at what they act, you know, the actual structure of the study, mm-hmm. because mm-hmm. you know, we saw that when we actually did that during the election, we saw that no one was asking about the essential questions that had been identified in it, which mm-hmm. had to do with people having jobs and, you know, income mm-hmm. insecurity and, you know, all of that. Mm-hmm. People weren't being asked that. They were being asked all the cartoon stuff that had to do with the TV narrative, as opposed to the stuff that related right. to their own lives. And so right. those polls predictably did not predict anything.
But, yes, absolutely.
But you know, that aside from, you know, not relying on polls, you cannot assume stability in any of the structures at present, given the condition of the entire system of structures.
Right, right. You know, Lenin referred to a crisis like this as a general crisis right. of the system. And I think, maybe not saying anything different, I would use the word a total crisis. A total crisis. It affects every area of the life of the society and all of its institutions, major institutions, minor institutions. You know, just one indicator is very important: the decline in print newspapers. And the fact that people are not buying them, people are not subscribing to them, and the decline in the viewership of all of the news channels and general stations, be it the cable news networks, MSNBC, CNN, Fox, or be it NBC, CBS, and ABC. People are not paying attention. People have retreated from all of the fundamental institutions of the society, which produces a crisis of legitimacy. And it is total, I would say, in a lot of senses, irreversible, and that people are saying that they reject the system, especially young people, saying they prefer socialism. And that's another problem
right.
for the Republicans, for the Republican Party. They want to run against socialism, and that's going to be a problem.
Yeah.
I mean, if not in 2018, in 2020, because people, even if it's a third party that can't win, it could be a third party that will decide who will win.
That's right.
You know, and if that party runs on a socialist platform, something like Eugene Debs in 1912, ran as a socialist and as a labor activist. Something similar to that could be the deciding force in a three-way national race.
Absolutely.
You know, and who knows what's going to happen at the conventions of both of the parties. Certainly, people are talking about the 50th anniversary of the 1968 Democratic Party convention in
right.
August 1968.
Right.
Well, we might be looking at something similar in 2020 in the Democratic Party, and maybe in the Republican Party. So this is a very unstable political moment. The people want answers. They don't want slogans. They don't want charismatic leaders.
Right.
They want real solutions to their problems.
They want to eat and live
yes.
indoors and have health care and be able to educate their kids and not mm-hmm. like stress all the time over that and feel that they were in a precarious situation with respect to those things.
And you know, the other thing, and this is probably a strong hand for Donald Trump, they want peace.
Yeah. Well, you can't have these others
without peace.
Yeah.
That's right.
And, you know... One of the things that I've been watching the political, it's almost sacrilege to refer to what goes on in the United States, you know, this electoral circus as politics, because it's you know, politics is supposed to be the place where public policy is made, the mechanism by which public policy is, you know, consensus for public policy is produced, and that it's set in motion to be actualized. And that isn't what happens here at all. That stuff is decided a priori, and the rest is just circus that's supposed to keep people entertained while the people who have decided what public policy is going to be go out actualizing it, you know, behind closed doors or wherever, and in our laps, in our faces, too, because part of their public policy is to, you know, further impoverish us and cart off whatever we might have silverware laying in the kitchen or whatever, and that they do right in front of us. So it's not all secret. But watching the, you know, the electoral game develop for around 2018, we had Bannon that was you know, going to be a third, fourth, or fifth force, whatever. He was going to go out and organize opposition to the establishment Republicans. We've seen, you talk about socialism, you know, we started seeing when Obama was first running, the phenomenon that the Republicans tried to call him, and the Democrats, some of them, tried to call him a communist or a socialist, and every time they did, he went up in the polls. And we've seen, you know, sort of the, with Sanders particularly, the readmission of the term socialist into political dialogue here. And the Republicans looking at that like, oh boy, because we can beat up on commies and pinkos. But the best thwarting of that the Democrats have been able to come up with is by not actually producing a real socialist. Every time they come up with one, they turn around and show, you know, how hard, you know, Bernie Sanders, the socialist, talking about Hugo Chavez, the dead communist dictator, you know, one of the worst war hawks out there. This one that won the primary here in New York, whose name escapes me at the moment, the young woman from Yorktown.
Ocasio-Cortez.
Okay. She couldn't gush about John McCain, the war criminal, enough in a tweet the other day. And I'm saying to myself, if you're farming for a constituency comprised of socialists, why are you fishing with that bait?
Yeah. You know, what I'm thinking is that a party of the people, a fusion of socialists and those who have not made up their minds about socialism, but who want a decent life across the board, rooted in the grassroots, such a party is what is on the agenda right now. And that's what the election of Ocasio-Cortez, of Gillum in Florida, and some others around the country suggest. Now, the mistake, I think, that the Democratic Socialists of America make is that they're going into the Democratic Party in order to transform it and take it back rather than to build outside of the Democratic Party among those forces, especially young people, who are for socialism and who despise the Democratic Party and, in fact, distrust an Ocasio-Cortez because, one, she's in the Democratic Party, and secondly, because of her statement vis-a-vis John McCain, which then puts her in the war party wing of the Democratic Party.
That's right.
And so, you know, the insurgents that brought us Bernie Sanders in 2016 are not going to follow them into the Democratic Party. Especially since the people who run it and control it are the same people responsible for stealing the election from Bernie Sanders.
You know, so, on top of that, just to interrupt 1 second, because you invoked before, you know, the image of the socialist presidential candidate in, you know, Eugene Debs. in what year was it?
1912.
And he ran again in 1916. And when he ran for president in 1916, he did it from in a prison. And the reason he was in prison was because he said, as a socialist, I am against all wars because they damage the working class. They're fought by the working class, against the working class, for the property classes, and I'm therefore against them. So these guys that are calling themselves socialists 100 years later and that are favoring imperialist wars are obviously not socialists.
Yeah, you know, it's so interesting that you bring that up. And sometimes how little we learn from history. You know, W.E.B. Du Bois, who became one of the great figures fighting for peace and was indicted by the American government because of that, said that the greatest mistake he ever made was to support Wilson's going into World War One. And now he had his reasons. He thought that it would rebound to civil rights at home. He felt, and he fought for there to be black officers over black troops, and that black troops not only do kitchen work and latrine work, but they be armed and in fighting units. And he also thought that German imperialism posed a greater threat to the enlargement of colonialism in Africa and Asia. But that was, that's a whole nother question. Yeah. But he said that was his greatest mistake.
Right.
Now, he supported Franklin Roosevelt in World War II and supported the Soviet Union. But he became, in the Cold War, this huge anti-war figure. Now, what have we learned, we socialists, and I put quotes around that, from history? And it seems to me very little, because by going into the Democratic Party, I think the DSA is frankly saying we're prepared to be the shock forces on the ground to elect Democrats and to prepare the ground for a Warren or whoever the Democratic Party candidate is in 2020. And we're prepared to compromise on the question of war and peace. And I think that's a compromise we cannot afford to make.
Yeah. If you're looking at this from a class perspective, which if you're concerned about working people is, you know, a given, well, you have to look at the world in that context. And the workers of the world are not the middle class voters in Westchester County, New York, but rather the people who are getting bombed by the imperialist shock troops around the world. They're the people whose blood is being sucked to finance this planet, the people who are working in mines at gunpoint and carrying the goods to ships offshore, the people whose agricultural products are being stolen from them and their labor, and the people that are forced to sit and starve in their own countries because all of the things of value have been taken out or are in the process of being taken out. That's the working class. If you're if you want to look out for workers, those are your allies, because if you don't protect them, that's your job next.
Well, you see, and here is the logic of the socialists in the Democratic Party compromising with the corporate Democrats. The logic of why they become a part of the war regime is that they agree with the elite on this Russiagate fraud. They agree.
Right.
Bernie Sanders, Ocasio, Cortez, and most of agree on the Russiagate thing. And everyone that knows anything knows it's a ruse. It's a political ploy to delegitimize the 2016 election and to get Trump out. It's a part of a moving coup d'etat, which is now failing, I think.
Right.
But once you go there, then, you know, it opens the door to everything, because then you have Russia as the enemy and so on. A lot of people say, well, do you support Putin? The question is not whether we support Putin. The question is, do we support peace and detente and denuclearization of Europe and the relations between the United States and Russia? That is the question. The question of Putin, what happens with him, is the problem for the Russian people, not for us.
That's right. Now, when we have solved our own problems.
Yes, then maybe we can advise them. Like him or not, we talked about it last week, the article in the Washington Times. Now, of course, I don't think many people, even after hearing our discussion of it and so on, have read that article or paid it much attention. That is one of the most important articles, and it explains a number of things, including Trump's distancing himself, if not his entire administration, from NATO.
Right.
And his saying after his meeting with Kim, or before his meeting with Kim Jong-un, or after, that the war games on the Korean Peninsula were dangerous war provocations.
Yeah.
Or his going against what Mattis said in terms of the other day, that we are going to resume military exercises with Japan and South Korea in the waters off of North Korea. And Trump said, no, we will not.
No, we're not.
Now, these are gestures, but in the fog of this internal political war, the truth and clarity become the first victims.
Right.
So rather than the peace movement seizing upon that, trying to hold this guy to what he says, the peace movement is silent about these things.
I know.
And these are very important events. Now, thankfully, the labor movement, which deals with the life of its membership, and its membership, their members are not doing that well, could not afford to be absent from the discussion of revising NAFTA. Now, whether it will solve all of the problems of the industrial workforce, I know it will not.
Right.
But it is relief on the way to resolving the deeper, more consequential problems of the entire working class.
All right, we got to stop there. Tony, thank you so much, and we'll speak
thank
with you again next week.
Appreciate it, Don. Take care.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.
Hello and welcome to Crosstalk, where all things are considered. I'm Peter Lavelle. A parting of ways, European leaders talk of a future without the U.S. What is in store for the Transatlantic Alliance? And much, much more on this edition of Crosstalk. Crosstalking some global trends. I'm joined by my guest here in Moscow, Mark Sloboda. He's an international affairs and security analyst. We also have Dmitry Babich. He's a political analyst with Sputnik International. And in Cyprus, we cross to Alex Grisoforo. He's the director and writer for the Duran.com. All right, gentlemen, crosstalk rules in effect. That means you can jump in anytime you want, and I always appreciate it. Alex, let me go to you first in Cyprus. Interesting trend going on. We have European leaders speaking out about a future without the United States in terms of the security arrangements, specifically NATO, and with the impending sanctions vis-a-vis the Iran situation, some Europeans are thinking out of the box for a change. For example, we have President Macron of France talking about Trump's aggressive isolationism. What's your take? Go ahead.
No chance that they'll be able to do anything without the United States. I think it's all talk. My opinion, I think that Europe is too intertwined, too owned by the United States. And to me, this is all about Trump. You know, these leaders, Macron, Merkel, you know, these guys, these neoliberals, what's been left of the Obama crew, so to speak, they just don't like Trump. They don't like to deal with Trump. They don't like his rhetoric. And so, you know, they've got a little bit of Trump derangement syndrome in Europe. But I don't think there's any chance in the near to medium term that Europe can do much without the United States. And I think we saw that with Juncker. I think Juncker went to Washington and he pretty much capitulated to whatever Trump wanted.
Yeah, but Mark, I mean, I agree with Alex broadly speaking, but there are very specific things like energy where the Germans and the Austrians and the Italians, et cetera, are going to go down their own path when it comes to energy security. They cannot rely upon an outside power here. This is what the brass tacks of it all. You know, European leaders can say, yeah, we'll spend more money on NATO, but they probably won't, okay? So there are important rhetorical areas, but there are certain policy areas that are very real.
Yeah, I agree with Alex. I think that what we're hearing right now is a lot of impotent whining and hand-wringing coming from the EU leaders. It is personal. Every other week, they're begging the United States to resume the mantle of global military hegemony and transatlantic leadership, as
they
call it.
So they don't have to do it.
They don't have. But they intend to wait Trump out. They think they can wait him out, whether it's another year, 2 years, however many years. They think they can wait him out. They're going to continue, of course, with Nord Stream, right? The Germans are not going to back down. That project has gone ahead too far, and their energy security is at risk. There is going to be no EU army. That's a lot of hot air. They can't even spend their
sanctions spending when it comes to Nord Stream?
Yeah. Sanctions when it comes to Nord Stream are as yet untested, and I think they do not expect that to be carried through. Sanctions on EU companies when it comes to Iran, that they're having to deal with right now. This blocking statute from 1996 with Cuba that we're reviving, they know very well it will have no effect whatsoever. The big European majors, Total, Maersk, Alliance, Danielle Steel, they're all already pulling out.
And who's going to replace them? I bet we could guess.
Russia and China are going to replace them.
Is this really all? I mean, when we look at how the European leaders are reacting to Trump, because I agree with Alex here, but really at the center of this, I guess it's the Paris Climate Accord and, importantly, the Iran deal. They see the United States as not a partner that they can trust because the U.S. can change its mind. It can pull out of internationally agreed treaties and agreements.
Well, I agree with Mark and Alex. Basically, there's one point where I agree that the EU will not do anything serious to help Iran. I mean, the European Commission has just earmarked $18 million in support of Iranian economy.
And the State Department didn't like it.
$8 million out of it in support of small private enterprises. Huge amount of money, right? So I don't expect it to be of significance. On the Nord Stream 2, I kind of a little disagree. I think it will always be under threat because Uniper, one of the European companies, has already said it would pull out of the project if the United States indeed imposed sanctions on any European companies participating in it. In general, I think if we take a broader look at it all, basically ultra-liberalism is the ideology in the European Union. That ideology can make alliances with extremist nationalists. They made an alliance with the nationalists in Ukraine. They made an alliance earlier with the nationalists in Poland. Now they're quarreling with them.
When the nationalism is directed outwards, not inwards.
Against Russia or against China. Yes, they're making alliances with nationalists who are acting against Russia, against China, against big countries, which are actually not hostile, but which the ultra-liberal ideology is targeting. And they can make an alliance with American nationalists. To my mind, neoconservatives, the so-called neocons, they are American nationalists. Basically, the EU can make an alliance with them against Russia.
Okay, well, let's say with the EU.
That's why there was no criticism of the U.S. sanctions against Russia from the EU. Criticism of Iranian sanctions, but no criticism of Russia sanctions.
To wrap up this point here, Alex, I mean, but again, we're in broad agreement here. I mean, doesn't it just end up being empty rhetoric? I mean, is Macron just has egg on his face because he can say one thing? They can talk about developing a European-wide SWIFT system, but if they don't do it, where's the credibility? Where's the credibility, Alex?
Yeah, I mean, Macron doesn't have much credibility at this point, and I think when EU leaders are talking about moving away from the U.S., I think you're exactly right, Peter. I don't think there's much to it, and I think an even more important point is that inside the EU, they can't reach much consensus. So while you can have a Macron or a Merkel saying one thing, you have other countries that are opposed to Nord Stream or are opposed to France and Germany's policies within the EU. And that also stretches to migration and other issues. So the EU just cannot act as a single unit to muster the strength to move away from the U.S.
Yeah, because they can't even talk among themselves at most. Mark, please put into perspective what is going on surrounding Syria right now, because depending on who you listen to, I'm not talking about the mainstream media because I don't talk about it very much, but there seems like a lot of rumblings going on right now. Go ahead.
Okay, so we're heading to a major watershed moment, a flashpoint in the Syrian conflict, which is something we've been talking about on the show for well over a year now, which is Idlib. This is this province bordering Turkey in the northwest of Syria. It's a mountainous area that is almost entirely under the control of HTS, Hayat Tahrir al-Sham, which even the U.S. State Department recognizes is al-Qaeda, or jihadist groups of various sundry alliances that are always fighting amongst each other under the umbrella of al-Qaeda, whose suzerainty they've all recognized. The Syrian army has finished the fight in the south, and they're now moving to retake Idlib. Idlib is supplied from Turkey. Turkey basically hoped to turn Idlib into another area of Turkish occupation under its proxy rule. It hasn't worked. So the Syrian military, the Russian forces are marshaling. They're ready to storm Idlib. And this will be the largest battle of the Syrian conflict so far. There are somewhere between 70 and 100,000 jihadists under arms.
But a number of people that are close to this situation here, Dima, see this as a proxy confrontation, because there are reports that elements of the U.S. Navy are moving closer in to the coast of Syria. The Defense Department denies it, but at the same time says that they're prepared for anything, so they kind of want to have it both ways. Is this a proxy potential confrontation here?
I think it's something worse. Basically, what we can see in the next few days is a false flag chemical attack in Syria.
Which is what the Russian Ministry of Defense...
Exactly. Russian media and Russian Ministry of Defense have been crying about it during the last 4 or 5 days. It got no traction in Europe, no traction in the United States. Pentagon said that we would strike if we have...
If
we have a chemical attack. A chemical attack may happen, but it may come from the rebels, and the white helmets are operating actively on that. So this is the first danger. Then it's not only the U.S. ships operating there. Two big Russian military vessels have crossed the Bosphorus Strait with caliber missiles.
There's 20 Russian naval vessels.
There are already 15, so there will be more coming. And this is becoming a more and more dangerous situation. But there is also another point that I would like to stress. The Russian foreign minister raised, I think, a very important issue. There are documents in the UN Security Council which basically forbid the European and American allies to economically help those areas of Syria which are under government control. Well, the Voltaire Network cites here a document entitled Parameters and Principles of UN Assistance, drawn by the Director of Political Affairs, the Political Affairs of United Nations, Jeffrey Feltman. This is really cruel, because when Europe says, we didn't destroy Syria, Russia destroyed Syria. You know, I read it in Frankfurter Allgemeine Zeitung that Putin wants us to pay for something he destroyed. Well, this is just a lie.
Well, this is
who supported
this is so
the rebellion?
That's very Orwellian. We're going to have another Orwellian story in the second part of the program. It's about John McCain. Let me go to Alex. Let's finish up here on Syria, because it does look to me that this is some kind of final attempt by the Western powers to make a statement. We still have Mattis, believe it or not, the defense secretary, talking about a future without Assad. I thought we got beyond that point. But no, they keep going back to that same point. Go ahead, Alex.
Yeah, they just can't let it go. And I agree with Mark and Dimitri. And to the point, going back on Europe, it's not only the United States that is making claims that they're ready to attack Syria. You have France and you have the UK jumping on board and saying that if there is a chemical weapon strike, something that everyone in alternative media is screaming about, from us to Zero Hedge, everyone is saying that there is going to be a chemical weapons false flag. The mainstream media is not reporting any of it.
All.
But if there is, yeah, and if there is, the UK and France have also said that they will get involved.
Well, they found something. Okay, gentlemen, I have to jump in here. We're going to go to a short break. And after that short break, we'll continue our discussion on some global trends. Stay with RT.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Right, let me go back to Alex in Cyprus here. Alex, you and I, a few days ago, had a long conversation about what's going on in South Africa. And then, lo and behold, again, our conversation was about the reported murder of white farmers, the seizure of land without compensation, how the South African government is dealing with it, grappling with it politically and internationally. And then a number of sources, particularly Tucker Carlson over at Fox News, talked about it. A few other people did, well-known YouTubers. You and I talked about it, and lo and behold, the South African government seems to be pulling back. Your thoughts?
Yeah, they are taking notice, and you noted in our discussion, Peter, that it's the PR part that the South African government is very worried about, and President Trump's tweet brought a lot of attention to what's going on in South Africa. It's a very complicated issue, but what we're seeing now is South Africa trying to explain how the land expropriation, what other people are calling theft, is going to take place. And in their comments, they're saying that they're not going to be taking all the land from farmers. They are going to leave land that is owned by Zulu tribe members intact, and then they're just going to be moving on other land. And they're about to take a very big piece of property, the first land seizure, from a guy named Johan Steenkamp. And the funny thing about his land is that he bought it 20 years ago
under the Mandela government. Right, after apartheid.
Exactly, after apartheid, and they're not going to compensate him whatsoever. And he said that he will defend his land. Well, and so things are really heating up.
So much for the rule of law. Thoughts on this, Mark?
It's a complicated issue. 72% of farmland in South Africa is owned by whites, and they are 9% of the population. The Land Restitution Act was originally enacted to restore land that had been seized from black farmers during the decades-long rule by the U.S. and U.K.-backed apartheid regime. It seems there have been some excesses towards that, and a lot of it hasn't actually happened. A lot of it has simply been political rhetoric from within some of the more extremist members of the African National Congress, and that is what maybe has been walked back more than anything else. Trump has blown this all out of proportion in an attempt to rally the white nationalist part of his base. Meanwhile, Russia, maybe
speaking out for the rule of law, Mark. I think that goes a bit too far, but I think.
But
there's so many people that have
which
talked.
Which law?
Exactly, and you need to have a conversation about that. How did you start, Mark? It's complicated. Dima.
Well, I would like to point some of our attention to the duplicity of the European Union about it, because when land seizures were underway in Zimbabwe,
good point,
and the EU hated Mugabe, there was a lot of noise about it in the media. Now, there is barely anything. And what is very important, talking about human rights violations in Africa, David Cameron, when he was in power several years ago, suggested stopping any economic aid to those African countries which do not recognize single-sex marriage, which is a cruel decision because a lot of African countries are Muslim. And again, Africa doesn't have to be on the same standard with the UK. You know, you can jump 200, 300 years. But Cameron did it. He enforced it. And now Theresa May and Angela Merkel, they're at the same time touring Africa right now. And they don't even mention it. They just say that Theresa May is very proud of allocating 0.7 of their budget for help to the developing countries, huge amount of money, right? And they're only talking about how they love Africa, and they don't respond to questions. The African Union was against the ousting of Gaddafi.
The whole mantra is that you accept Western values and you accept a Western tradition when it comes to racism, being anti-racist, the rule of law, etc., etc. That's the reason why, Dima, they don't want to talk about it,
yes,
okay?
And
because all these issues in South Africa are in play. And as Mark said, It's complicated.
Yes. Well, I would say that you have to be a part of a fashionable minority. Whites in South Africa are now a minority, but they're not fashionable.
Well, they're not victims enough for liberals to care about. This is a big topic. I'm going to stay on it. Alex, I want to go back to you. Talking about human rights, I'm reading a title from the Washington Post by a woman named Jennifer Rubin. The human rights community lost a champion. Who is she talking about? Oh, there's a picture of John McCain. Your thoughts?
A picture of John McCain standing next to Oleg Chernobok, the neo-Nazi leader of Ukraine, yeah, who formed the Social Nationalist Party and then went on to form Svoboda and won as one of the three big leaders of McCain, who even the Western mainstream media grudgingly admits is a neo-Nazi.
Alex, jump in.
A picture is worth a thousand words in that case. I mean, it's ridiculous to see everyone piling on left and right, from Hillary Clinton to John Lewis to Bernie Sanders, Ocasio-Cortez, yeah, praising John McCain as a peacemaker, as a man of peace. I mean, have people forgotten Libya, Syria, Ukraine, Iraq, bomb, Iran? I mean, it's comical at this point.
You know, it's, you know, but Dima is, you know, John McCain was an exemplar of American foreign interventions, military interventions around the world. And the interesting thing is that just about every single intervention John McCain supported ended up in failure and misery. But that is, you don't see that in the Washington Post.
You don't see it. In the Washington Post, you see also David Ignatius, who is praising McCain for being against climate change, and he quotes McCain as saying, "The worst thing I can do is to sell my soul to the devil. I won't do it even for Republican nomination." Well, you know,
unpack that statement.
Hundreds of thousands of people killed in Vietnam, and McCain never repented for that, and he did not sell his soul to the devil. Now, I think there is a very interesting story about that. I think we should all thank McCain for not inviting Mr. Tagnibok, whom Mark has just mentioned, and who called for attacks against Jews in Ukraine. McCain didn't ask him to carry his coffin, but he asked some Vladimir Kara-Murza, a prominent liberal anti-Putin activist, who suggested Putin all the rich businessmen living under Putin regime under sanctions, you know, in the United States and in Europe. He will be carrying McCain's coffin on McCain's personal invitation. And I saw that it's like about 20 people, you know. How can they carry all that?
I thought Al-Qaeda would be the pallbearers.
Ah, wait, I have it for you. Okay, so Azzam Houthaya, the son of Abdullah Azzam, bin Laden's mentor, had this to say on Twitter. He paid tribute to McCain and said that his death is very suspicious coming right now, considering the honorable stance he has taken towards the revolution of Al-Qaeda in Syria.
He has been arranging his funeral for several months, but still, the death is suspicious.
We all know that Donald Trump isn't going to go there. All right, I want to change gears. I want to talk about North Korea. We've heard from media reports that a belligerent letter came from North Korea to the State Department about what motives and questions the administration may have about pursuing this peace process here. It's a very sketchy media reports, and interpreting it seems to be a bit murky as well. Go ahead, Alex.
Yeah, the letter was interpreted by Reuters, who kicked it off by calling it belligerent, and that was in their title. They have since retracted the word belligerent from their title because the real content came out, and it was anything but belligerent. Basically, North Korea was just asking the Trump administration, "We have 3 points that we agreed upon. What's going on with these 3 points? How are we moving forward?" And so this was a really poor attempt to frame the narrative that North Korea was threatening the United States.
Yeah. You know, Mark, it's as if the media and the left don't want a peace process to be put into place. And I guess the deep state doesn't want to lose all of those contracts that it's had for decades pouring money into the Korean Peninsula.
Yeah, I think part of this is simply because this is seen as Trump's initiative, often even bucking his own administration. That, and at this point, the Democrats have called so far in bed with the neocons that you can't even tell
the
who's sleeping
now
on which side of the bed at this point. But what North Korea asked is simply, we've agreed on 3 points following the Singapore statement and the Panmunjom declaration between North Korea and South Korea, that we start improving relations, we sign a peace treaty, finally ending the North Korean war decades later, then we start talking about denuclearization of the peninsula, the whole peninsula.
The whole peninsula.
And you know, this is predictable that this is that the Trump administration wants to drop this because, you know, again, I saw this as Trump's initiative that his own neocon administration wasn't behind. But what's important going forward is how South Korea and Moon Jae-in react to this. Do they? Mattis has announced that U.S. military drills will recommence on the peninsula. Is South Korea going to play along? That's what I want to know.
Dima,
well,
last word.
I like how Mattis put it. He said that the United States ran out of good faith, you know. And this was a belligerent letter, not even from Kim Jong-un, from Kim Yong-chol, the vice chairman of North Korea. And that letter is belligerent. And the U.S., the U.S., South Korean military exercises every year on the Korean Peninsula are not belligerent, right? With hundreds of thousands of troops, with most sophisticated weapons tested, you know, weapons that can destroy Pyongyang in several minutes. This is not belligerent. Just a letter from Kim Yong-chol is
belligerent. I think what's really interesting, I'm going to finish on this point here, I think what's really interesting, what we've said on this program from the very beginning, really is what's most important here is how the two Koreas engage each other. Keep your eye on that. That's all the time we have. Many thanks for my guests here in Moscow and in Cyprus. This is the end of our broadcast segment. Stay with us for the extended version on our YouTube channel. See you next time, and remember, Crosstalk rules.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR, CommunityPublicRadio.org. I'm your host, Don DeBar.